you've taken your first step into a larger world. Let's go.
Hello there. I'm Rowan Williams.
I'm Baz McAllister.
And welcome to Force Material, where this week we are joined by two very special guests to break down this week's episode of The Mandalorian, Chapter 10, The Passenger. Our first guest is a correspondent for ABC News in the US. You might have seen him on shows like Good Morning America, ABC World News Tonight, This Week, and Nightline. He's also ABC's resident Star Wars fan, and yes, we will be finding out how he earned this prestigious title. And he's the producer of The Force of Sound, which is a documentary on the sound design of The Last Jedi. He is clearly one of America's foremost Star Wars fans, Clayton Sandell. Clayton, welcome to the show.
Good morning, guys. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for asking.
No worries. And our next guest just flew here from Maldo Crease, and boy, are his S-foils tired. He is our first ever three-time guest, the star of the beloved sitcom Kim's Convenience, a two-time Canadian Screen Awards winner, the host of a YouTube series called My Geeky Basement, and a dedicated Star Wars fan who makes his own props and costumes. He's also a man who's very good at keeping secrets. He plays X-Wing pilot Carson Teva in the episode of The Mandalorian that we are about to discuss. It's Paul Sun-Hyung Lee. Paul, thanks for joining us on short notice, mate.
Thank you so much for having me. I got the hat trick three times on the show, huh?
That's right, the first one. Now you're also the first person to join us on one of these Mandalorian recaps who was actually in the episode that we'll be talking about. So it's an interesting perspective that you'll have.
Yeah.
But Paul, we do have to start with that. I mean, the first two times you're on the show, you know, you were here as a fellow fan. We dived deep into your love of Star Wars. But somehow, you know, and for very good reasons, I'm sure, you neglected to mention that you were going to be in Star Wars. How did you manage to keep something this big a secret?
It wasn't easy. It's not easy. Luckily enough, though, you know, Disney and Lucasfilm, they have something called an NDA, which I'm required to sign if I want the gig. And it's
one that'll of these, do it.
Yeah. You don't want to, if you get an opportunity like this, you don't want to blow it. So it's one of these things where I'm going to keep my mouth shut because I don't want to be the guy that lost the gig because he couldn't shut up about it. So it was hard, though. It's really hard, especially when you're a fan, because you just want to share it with everybody. Keep your eyes on the prize. So now it's nice to be able to finally talk about it.
So it was like a year, right, that you had to sort of keep this under your hat?
Yeah, a little bit longer than a year, which was really, really tough. And especially when people are talking about the show and you know, it's like in the back of your head, you go, I know a secret. Get some of that background information. You can't share any of it because then you're tipping your hand. It's a very, very interesting exercise in self-control and discipline.
So for any listeners who haven't seen Kim's Convenience before, and I mean, in that case, what are you doing? And if you didn't immediately recognize Paul in the episode, he plays one of the two X-Wing pilots who chases the Mando and eventually saves the Mando and Baby Yoda's butts in the end. Now, the other pilot is played by Dave Filoni, but you get the lion's share of the lines of the two pilots, and rightly so. And your character is named Captain Carson Teva, but Baz, I believe you had a suggestion for the name of Paul's astromech droid that I hope the folks at Lucasfilm will take on board.
Yes, I'm about to start a campaign lobbying very hard for your droid, Paul, to be called OKCU, because I think that's the only fitting name, really.
Fun story, when we were on set and they were bringing out the astromech droids, they literally, it was the same body, but they changed the heads on it. And Filoni, his had a more of an R5 sort of, instead of the dome top, it was the sort of the flat top like R5 in A New Hope was. Mm-hmm. He had it custom painted because he's a huge Pittsburgh Penguins fan. His helmet, if you look at the design of the helmet, it's different from the one he wore in season one. You know, it's good to be the creator of a show, co-creator of a show, and an executive producer because he gets all those perks.
yeah, and he gets to call himself Trapper Wolf.
Exactly. I had actually jokingly said, hey, did you call him OKCU for my droid? And they said, no. It's an R2 unit, so an astromech unit has to always start with an R. And I thought, huh.
Good point.
Okay. I don't know, though, because Chopper's an astromech.
Exactly. Exactly.
He called something different. But, you know, don't poke the bear, right? But the lovely thing was, Dave also has an affinity towards GO Trains. The GO Train service in Ontario, in Toronto as well, he's passionate about them, and they've got a color scheme, and they're white and green. So my droid was actually, you can't tell, but it was painted white and green. And I thought, okay, well, why don't we call it R2TO? T-O meaning Toronto. It's a short.
Yeah. Word.
Amazing.
It's a fun little story.
That's fantastic. And to think that, you know, when the trailer came out, that was, you know, your fighter in the trailer. And we were sort of breaking that down and saying, well, the Jedi are going to be involved in this season. Maybe that's Luke Skywalker and R2-D2 in that X-Wing.
I should clarify, Baz, that was you who thought it was Luke Skywalker.
That was me.
Very not on board.
Very happy to be wrong in this case.
That was a big one. I remember that's one of my favorite fan theories. And I had to bite my lip for that. And he texts me. And, you know, he sort of teases, hey, your episode's coming up and this and that. And I remember texting back saying, you know, it's going to be really interesting because the fans are really swinging for the fences. And they think, have you heard that they think Luke Skywalker is in the X-Wings? And he texts back, he said, boy, they're going to be really disappointed. It's me and you. It's like, oh, yeah, here it comes. But yeah.
Well, that's the funny thing, because when we saw that it was you, I think the people like five houses down would have heard me reacting to seeing you in that cockpit. That was quite a moment. So that it's one of the few things that could have topped it being Luke Skywalker for me. That was incredible.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I think you're one of 10 people, probably.
Another one right here.
Oh, thanks. The reaction here has been off the hook. My phone started going, like it almost melted because it premieres at like 12:01 Pacific time. I mean, Eastern time. So basically 3 in the morning. And at about 3:40 in the morning, my phone started going. And when I woke up at around 5:30, there were so many messages and tweets and this and that. I had no idea. Like I thought there'd be some reaction, but not to the level it's gotten. And then the local media started covering it. And I just kind of thought, oh my God, what is this? And Deborah Chow is a friend of mine too. She texted me. I said, this is crazy. The response, she says, I went through it last year. And she said, Star Wars, you know, the fans are very intense and they love it. They love it. And so they do the deep dive. Like people have been doing research and people knew who I was because they'd gone into the whole IMDb search and they put all these links together. It's like really, it's super intense, but it's super cool too. I mean, that just shows the passion of the fans. Mm. So it was, but it was really, really unexpected, like to the level it got to.
Yeah. So Paul, we'll come back obviously to your role in the episode as we go, because I've got a ton more questions about it. But Clayton, I want to get your thoughts. I mean, Clayton, you're obviously the resident Star Wars fan at ABC News. So Clayton is responsible for a lot of ABC Star Wars coverage. How did that kind of come about?
Quite by accident. I had always been a Star Wars fan. And when the announcement came that Disney had purchased Lucasfilm and we were getting new movies, it was almost for me like my own fan reawakening. And I told my wife that year, it was, you know, 2015. I told her that the one thing I wanted for Christmas was just to get a 3-day pass to go to Celebration. I took off time from work, took vacation days, was all set to go do it. And about a week before Celebration Anaheim, my boss called and he said, you know, if you're going to be there anyway, you may as well, if you want to file from there, you may as well work. And, it took me about 3 seconds to say yes. And, so we spent Celebration just running around, a producer friend of mine, Ronnie Polidoro, who's also a huge Star Wars fan. We just ran around Celebration for a couple of days and filed a bunch of stories. And it was this just tremendous, it was so good to sort of be back in that world, because I was always a fan, but I was never like a hardcore fan. You know, it was always, I was never not going to be a Star Wars fan, but I just hadn't been as active in recent years. And so that was that experience of getting a few stories on the air, and it sort of clicked in my brain. It's like, you know what? I could do this more. This could be a lot of fun. And so it really just kind of became, I call it my side hustle at ABC. Star Wars is my side hustle because, you know, my regular job is, I'm not an entertainment reporter. I'm not based in LA, but I, you know, and normally what I do is I go out and I cover tragedies and natural disasters and all sorts of bad stuff. So it sort of became my mental health reset, really, you know, to go out every few months and maybe do a Star Wars story here and there. And so that's what I've tried to do. It's not a full-time thing, but like I said, it's my side hustle and I love it.
Yeah. It must be a good little palate cleanser after all of those hard news stories to jump into something Star Wars related.
100%. And it's taken me overseas a couple of times. We interviewed Mark Hamill in Ireland. So yeah, it's just kind of been a whole series of pinch me kind of moments. And, you know, one of the things that, for me, when Return of the Jedi left the theaters, I, like a lot of fans, kind of thought that was it. All right, we're done. Mm. And so I sort of dove into a lot of the behind the scenes stuff. So got every ILM book that I could, you know, and really dove into the behind the scenes stuff. So one of the things that I've really had a lot of fun doing is going to ILM and doing these features on the visual effects of Solo, or, you know, the sound design of The Last Jedi. Mm-hmm. And that to me has been just as magical as meeting the actors, because these, you know, literally, you know, these visual effects wizards are so talented, and the stuff they come up with is amazing. And so that's been really fun to me, is to try and, you know, pull the curtain back a little bit on some of the visual effects behind the scenes stuff. It's kind of been my own specialty, but I love it all.
Mm. Is that something, Clayton, that you are drawn to when you watch new Star Wars content? So a lot of our listeners would have seen The Force of Sound, the documentary on sound design that you put together for Last Jedi for ABC News Features. But when you watch an episode of The Mando like this, are you sort of registering sound design, or are you just letting everything wash over you? You know, has it ruined your ability to kind of tap into the purity of it?
Yeah, I always, you know, it's funny because, like, on The Last Jedi, they talk about how the Porg sound was created by recording the chickens in the Skywalker Ranch chicken coop, right? And then taking it and speeding it up. So when I hear some weird new alien sound or weird new ship sound, I do sometimes go to that spot of, you know, I wonder what that was originally, you know, like a broken toaster or something. You know, it's like, who knows? But no, I let it try and kind of wash over me. And, but you know, certain things do stand out. I think the sound design on this show has been tremendous, and the visual effects, are, you know, as good as any movie that's out there. It's spectacular.
Mm. This was, this particular episode, chapter 10, was Peyton Reed's first episode in the director's chair. He's probably best known, I think, to, you know, the general public, I would say, for directing the two Ant-Man films. I mean, Clayton, do you sort of think he brought, you know, some of the style from those MCU films to this episode of the show?
I think a little bit. I also think, I was talking to somebody about the themes of the episode too, and I think maybe theme wise more so than visual wise a little bit for me. Mm-hmm. I thought there was a lot of you know, this Mando and the child in this episode really spoke to me as a parent.
Oh yeah.
as a parent of a 7-year-old. And you see those relationships in like the Ant-Man
film. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so theme wise, I think he did.
Yeah. And Paul, was Peyton, you know, would you call him an actor's director? Did he have, you know, did he have a lot of notes on your performance, or was it just a, you know, a George Lucas style, case of faster, more intense?
No, he was great. I, having never worked with him, before, Canadian. he was great. I mean, every director has a different style and whatnot. He was very, he was fun to work with, to be honest. He and Filoni were joking back and forth a lot of times, and they were taking the piss out of a lot of stuff from the original some of the characters in A New Hope, actually, because they had a lot of Brits playing with American accents. Mm. And if you listen to some of the dialogue, it sounds a bit stilted. So they would sort of take these lines like, you know, this some of the fighter pilots in their speak when they're talking about, you know, the different attack runs, and some of the Imperial officers, like the one on the Tantive IV, when he's talking to Vader, and he's like, you know, the Imperial Senate will never stand for this. And guys, obviously, he's just putting on an accent. So there was a lot of that going on, which was fun. But he was great. They sort of, you're so immersed on that set because you're in the volume. And when you talk about the visual effects, there's no green screen. It's there. Mm. And I remember I'm in the cockpit. It's a repurposed cockpit from Rogue One. I've got all the gear on. I'm strapped in there. And they start playing with the starfield, and they start making it go like rock back and forth. And I grab onto the side, and this thing is bolted to the ground. It's not moving anywhere. But every sense of your body is telling you, you're doing this. And, you know, Peyton's got a microphone. He says, look, if you're feeling sick, just focus in on an instrument panel in front of you. And that's the power of the effects that they have right there. And as an actor, as a performer, it just brings you right into there. And so in the episode, we're chasing the Razor Crest through the ice planet. And they've got this loop going, and it feels like you're flying this X-Wing going in there. And so it's really, any notes I got were just for more physicality. It's like, you're feeling the G's, like, you know, I want to hear some grunting, like, this is hard on your body, stuff like that, which never made the final cut. But it's fun as an actor to play in that kind of sandbox because you're there. He was great in terms of giving notes, stylistically, what they were looking for in terms of the delivery. Mm-hmm. A lot of the dialogue at the beginning, especially when we're grilling the Mandalorian about, you know, running his tabs. It's like, you know, you don't have a transponder on. And we're kind of like the cops that are, you know, they're giving the guy a little bit of a hard time.
100%.
And that was great. And that was Favreau's idea, too, in terms of when he was explaining the scene to me. It's like, this is what they're about, because they're the new law. They're there to enforce things, and they're messing with him a little bit, right? And it's just this whole angling him. As an actor, it was a dream come true to just work with directors of that caliber, and having Filoni as your wingman is just like, come on, it's not
better than that. Well, that, you know, what you were saying about they're like, you know, they're like cops who are giving the guy a bit of a hard time. I mean, that's one of the things that's really interesting about setting the show in this time period, right? Is it's like a transitional sort of period for the galaxy. So, you know, you've got the New Republic, who we've sort of known as the Rebellion, and the Rebellion have become the cops, and it's all, you know, it's kind of new to them at this point as well.
Yeah. And I kind of akin them to, like U.S. Marshals back in the Old West, because they had a lot of ground to cover, and they're the law, but there's so much space, and they can only be at certain spots at a time. So they, you know, that's why you don't see them. But when they do show up, you got to watch, you got to respect these guys, because they'll mess you up. And that was it. I mean, that whole with the ice cavern at the end too, the biggest thing is you see them meticulously picking off all these little spiders. If they were stormtroopers, Mando would be dead. And that's sort of like that whole idea of, you know, the Republic, the New Republic, they're crack shots. These guys, you don't mess with them. Season one, when the three X-Wings show up, they're scared because they know they're going to get messed up, right?
Yeah. And
they bring the pain. So it's really neat having that sort of, it helps to frame it in a very familiar sort of backdrop, because I used to watch Westerns when I was a kid growing up too. And it's that whole, it's really, really cool playing it that way. But you're in the Star Wars universe.
There's a great line in season one that I keep coming back to, where Mando refers to the New Republic as a joke. And I'm thinking maybe he will reassess that after this episode. I think that he might have a different opinion.
Yeah, I think so.
Now, we get right into the action at the start of this episode, with Mando kind of being set upon by bounty hunters in the desert. You know, and obviously Peyton Reed's experience directing action sequences seems to sort of come in handy straight away here. And I mean, guys, what did we all think of the jetpack move?
I loved it. I thought it was great. And what I loved even better was the child's reaction when he kind of turns and looks up at Mando after the maneuver, and he's like, really? Yeah. Like, yeah. And Mando kind of gives this, I love, and I talked about this in the first episode, chapter 9 too. Just the A plus body language that has to happen in these episodes. There were the scene where Cobb Vanth walks into the cantina in chapter 9, and then here in that little exchange between the child and Mando was just superb. You understand instantly what is going on between them. The communication is completely communicated, even though one's a puppet and one you can't see his face.
Mm. And that theme of like parenting was so strong in this episode, both obviously like the relationship with Mando and Baby Yoda, but then, you know, Frog Lady and her spawn and even, you know, the spiders and the eggs. Like that was something that sort of connected everything in this episode together.
Mm-hmm.
So Mando heads into the cantina and we see this human-sized ant named Dr. Mandible. Paul, if you weren't in this episode, Dr. Mandible would be the character find of the year. I thought that this might have been an Ant-Man reference, but apparently Dr. Mandible was actually already there in the background in season one. I mean, did you guys sort of instantly fall in love with Dr. Mandible as well?
You know, it's funny because I didn't make that connection between Peyton and Ant-Man and Dr. Mandible right there, right away. Because I don't remember seeing Dr. Mandible in the background, and so it just seemed like a natural extension. And it wasn't until somebody pointed it out that I went, "Oh, right, that's clever." So I believe it when they say that it was not a conscious decision to bring a gigantic ant into the episode. Or
does seem a little on the nose, doesn't it? Just
funny though, the day I was shooting Peyton, it was the 20th anniversary of the release of his first movie he ever directed, I think. Bring It On. Yeah, it was the cheerleading movie, Bring It On.
Yeah, yeah. And,
yeah, so everybody was kind of giving him a hard time about that on the set. Because, well, you got a long way, right? But it was a lot of fun. So it's funny because immediately that's how I associated Peyton after that, because it's not the director of Ant-Man and Ant-Man and the Wasp. It's like, you're the director of Bring It On. And we'd all seen it. You know, it was a movie about cheerleaders. Yeah, man, I saw it 20 years ago when I was younger, and I loved it. So it was really cool about that. But yeah, that connection with the ants, I thought, it was it's great thinking about it in the end. But yeah, I totally believe the fact that it was not purposefully set that, but a great character too in terms of giving away. If I love how they're popular, they use practical. He wasn't a CGI ant. It was a puppet or somebody in a suit. It was great, and that's what I love about the Mandalorian, because the characters are made. They're rooted in belief. They're not realistic, but they're believable. Mm. And so I kind of love that. And Filoni would always say that too. Being hyper real doesn't stand up to making it believable. If you have a character that is believable, then you can forgive the fact that it's not picture-perfect realistic.
I love the name as well, because they could have called that character something like Hrothgar Hordik or, you know, whatever. But now they've gone for Dr. Mandible, which is like such a 70s action figure name. Like Walrus.
Yeah, it's so on the nose. It's so good.
And you got Frog Lady. You know, we're getting back to those kind of slightly maybe insensitive nicknames for aliens. So I think it's awesome.
And Mando accepts a job here, obviously, to take Frog Lady on this sublight trip. I'll be honest, somewhat flimsy premise that there's a Mandalorian covert waiting for him at on the other end of the journey. It does seem clear now that the sort of whole conceit of Mando looking for other Mandos to point him in the direction of the Jedi is kind of just, I'm sure it'll end up being important later on, but at the moment it seems like it's just a way to kind of loosely tie together these episodic stories. Clayton, there's been a bit of talk about, you know, like whether an episode like this is like a filler episode or whether every episode needs to be part of like, you know, an obvious part of the overall narrative arc of the show. I mean, where do you kind of stand on that? Do you see something like this as a filler episode?
You know, I don't really get the filler episode argument that people make. I have a hard time believing that you have these incredibly creative, talented people who are sitting around and they're like, all right, we're going to just sort of concentrate on, you know, episode, chapter 9, 12, 13. So, and then the rest, we'll fill in the rest as we go. I don't buy that. There's so few episodes that I think this has to be fairly plotted out. There's really no time to waste. So I really don't buy it. And I was kind of trying to think of an analogy, and I might have been hungry at the time, but I was thinking it's like a charcuterie board, right? It's like you can't have all the same thing on there. It's, you know, you gotta have the good salami, and you gotta have some cheese over here and some crackers over here. When you step back and look at the whole thing, it's this beautifully laid out display. And I think when you take a step back and you look at all these episodes as a whole, they all have their purpose. They all kind of fit into a greater thing. Yeah, individually, maybe you don't like that kind of cheese, or maybe fine. But when you take a step back and look at all of it, I think it'll fit in, and I think it'll all make sense. I enjoyed the episode. I really did. And it's one step on what I consider to be this much longer, bigger journey. And so, yeah, the idea that it's filler, I don't know. To me, it doesn't really hold water. I don't buy it.
100% agree. 100% agree, Clayton. I think you hit the nail right on the head with that. And I'm hungry now because we're talking about charcuterie board. It's almost lunchtime for me here. You're absolutely right. There isn't enough time. They've only got, what, eight episodes?
Yeah, eight, right.
Yeah, people really think, well, yeah, we're going to just, four will just be about the story and the rest will be just whatever we want it to be. Everything, if you look at it, like you say, everything has a place. They have to be as efficient as possible. And it's character building, it's theme building, it's all these, everything that makes it onto the show means something. And I think as fans, sometimes we become a little bit too impatient because we want the answers right away. And I see that with my kids too, because they're like, oh, they're watching Home Alone and they're bored. Mm. And they're just waiting for the end where all the traps get sprung. But I say, it's a buildup. This is all building up for the payoff. And when the payoff comes, everything that comes before leads to that moment. And so you have to be patient and you have to observe and see what comes. Because as a whole, like the charcuterie board, when you look at it and step back, you go, wow, that was genius. That was how they plotted it up. I'm biased, obviously. But when you see these guys working, and they work hard, they are going over as much as they can, the minutiae. They're planning stuff out because they care about the series. They care about the fans. They want to tell great stories, not just good stories. They want to tell great stories. And I see that, and I appreciate that as an actor, as a fan. I appreciate the level of commitment that they're putting in, and they talk about everything. And so when these things get missed and people get mad, they're not doing it on purpose. Obviously, mistakes will happen. Everybody's human, but they have a lot of people working really hard to bring this universe to life and to expand on it and to bring these characters and the whole idea of what the New Republic is and what's happening in the Outer Rim. That's all stuff that hasn't really been explored yet. And so they're meticulously trying to put it together. So if they don't find a Jedi within the first 5 minutes of the first episode, you're going to have to wait a little bit. It's going to be worth the journey, I think. It'll be worth it.
Yeah. And
just enjoy the ride, man. Enjoy the ride.
I was going to say, we talked a little bit in the last recap episode about, you know, in that, if when you look back at that first season, obviously those sort of first three episodes and the last two episodes are sort of very, you know, it's obvious that they're kind of like the narrative meat of that season or whatever. But then if you look at those middle three episodes, there's so many moments in those and or like characters that were introduced or character motivations that were kind of explained or just little details that ended up being important later on, even if it wasn't like super obvious at the time that they were important. So yeah, it's like it's all part of the tapestry of the show.
Mm. Yeah, and we're not talking like a 22 episode arc where it's like, you know, the number of episodes far outweighs the story that they're trying to tell. It's not like that at all. It's not like the only example I come up is with Lost, where they thought, well, we're just going to get one season, and so we'll layer all this stuff. It's like, you want another season? Oh, we hadn't planned on that. It's like, we have another 22 episode order. How do we stretch out the story? It's not that at all, right? So people have to be a little bit more cognizant of the fact and trust in the storytellers.
Mm. Yeah. Guys, we ate all the, we finished the charcuterie. Can we get some more charcuterie up?
I think it's also fun to dive into some of those details. And the one example I just was thinking of, that in season one, the episode on the, where they bust the prisoner out of that prison ship, and that droid that was flying the Razor Crest shows up again and play, that you could argue that maybe that was a filler episode from season one. It didn't really advance the story necessarily. But that droid that played a key role in that episode comes back and plays a key role in this episode as a translator for Frog Lady. So, the connective tissue here, if you sit back and enjoy it and wait for it and watch for it, is a lot of fun.
And, it drives the plot, that episode in this one as well. Like, if the Mando had never been seen in the vicinity of that ship, then, Carson Teva would have let him go on his way. So, yeah, none of this would ever happen.
And wouldn't have necessarily saved him at the end.
That's right.
Had he not done them a solid by rounding up those prisoners at the end of the episode.
We got a lovely sort of reappearance from an actor from season one, even though the character's not there anymore. Misty Rosas, who did the physical performance of Queel, came back as Frog Lady. And Frog Lady is voiced by Dee Bradley Baker of Clone Wars fame. So I don't know what you guys thought about that character. I loved her because she's just a mum. She's not a pilot, she's not a Jedi, she's not a soldier, she's just a concerned mom trying to make her way in the galaxy. And I think there was something lovely about that. What do you guys think about Frog Lady?
I got a chance to chat with Misty while I was on set, and she's a phenomenal human being as well, which is great. And her training in terms of the physicality, because of what she brings to the table in terms of working with the prosthetics, and it's not just her physical, she's working with the controllers of the facial, the guys that run the remote controls for the face. So it is a different type of collaborative acting that you're working on. And so it was really cool listening to her process and listening to what she brings to the table and her sort of mindset as she plays all these different characters. And so I love the Frog Lady. I thought it was great. I think for somebody who's just someone, she's a crack shot, because that was pretty good shooting right on top of the tele moment there. And I was lucky that she could shoot. I thought it was, I thought she was a little bit, the only thing that really sort of struck me about the character was, does she not count her eggs and realize
that whole lack of God? Yep.
Because there's a lot less in that canister than there were. I mean, unless it's one of these nature things where it's like, well, we assume that a percentage of them aren't going to make it. And since they're not fertilized yet, they're not really, wow, that's like, there's quite a few missing, and she seems very, very nonplussed about it. So,
well, I was going to ask you guys about, what you thought of Egg Thief Baby Yoda, Baby Ovivore in this episode. I mean, look, not my favorite thing that he's done. I was kind of cheering for the spiders later in the episode, if I can be honest, after he ate one of their eggs. What was up with that? I guess it's kind of, you forget because, you see Yoda. I think it's interesting to remember, like, he's a baby and he's still kind of developing, like, his sense of morality, I guess, and we're kind of seeing him develop that sense of right and wrong as the show goes along.
It was interesting. I thought in the whole egg eating thing and the being hungry all the time sort of took me back to something they did in Chapter 9, which may be a little bit of foreshadowing or forecasting here, where Peli mentions to Mando when he lands back on Tatooine that if this thing ever spawns or divides, I'll take one, or whatever, however she worded it. So I kind of wonder if the whole, now he's on this growth spurt, maybe that may be setting up something that happens with the child biologically later. Mm. I don't know. But it seemed, those two seem to be connected a little bit. But I agree. She's terrible with math and keeping track of how many eggs she's got.
It was interesting, though, in those scenes where we saw Baby Yoda kind of approach the egg canister, I thought the score for those scenes was really interesting, because it was kind of, I don't know, it, it seemed like maybe there's more going on there than we know at this point, because the score kind of had this like kind of enigmatic almost, and almost it was weird. It was like it was meant to be like a kind of heartwarming moment almost. And I'm like, but he's stealing those eggs. And you kind of go like, oh, well, maybe there's something going on here that we don't understand yet. And like you say, Clayton, maybe it does tie in with like the growth of Baby Yoda or something about the way that he, you know, recreates or whatever that we don't understand yet. But yeah, I my guess is that we're going to come back to this, and there's going to turn out to be maybe a little bit more to that than we thought.
Yeah, maybe he's not eating them. Maybe he's protecting them. Who knows? And we'll see them again.
There hasn't been this much youngling murder in a Star Wars property since Episode 3.
They did establish that he likes frogs, though. I mean, he did
eat a frog
in one. He had it in its mouth. And I think that's the only time he's used the Force. The season where he goes up to the tank and you hear the low rumbling of that, and he draws the eggs sort of towards him. It was like, oh, so all those spiders and you didn't use the Force, but you're hungry. You're going to draw it up. And they did play those scenes to, comedic effect. Because at the end, when he sneaks at you find he's stolen one last morsel and he puts it in his mouth. So it's just weird if there is something. I mean, I think the tone that they set with it was a little bit sort of, they did play it for humor. So I'm wondering how high stakes that's actually going to make it. It's just, through that, it's just sort of like, it's popcorn chicken. I just can't stop eating one. And he just keeps going.
I think the thing that bothers me most about it is that you know, it's we're told that this mom is taking these eggs to the only planet where she can spawn, and it's very important to the survival of her species, and she's sentient as well. It's not like Baby Yoda's just munching down on frogs, which you can find under any rock. It's like he's eating the future of a race, and I'm like, oh, I don't know about that. It's a bit icky.
Yeah, it's not great. Now, it's at this point of the story that the Razor Crest is pulled over by a couple of New Republic X-Wing pilots, one of whom, obviously, is, as we've said, is played by Paul. Now, you know, even before they cut to Paul, you know, we physically see you, you know, even before that, you get one of the best lines in the entire show so far, I thought, when Mando says, "May the Force be with you," and your character, like a good Catholic, responds, "And also with you." Was that improvised, or was that something that was scripted?
I was in the script, 100% in the script, and it was a question of how to play it, because when I read that, I thought, oh, wow, I was raised Catholic, so I thought, okay, that's the deep dive into that. But I kind of thought, because originally I kind of played it as he's kind of like, oh, I haven't heard that in a while, and also with you.
And also with
like,
you, yeah.
This is kind of suspicious, right? Like, it kind of caught him off guard there. They obviously went with a different take. But it's just something that was in the script from day one. And in fact, somebody reached out on Twitter saying, you know, all Catholics are thanking you for canonizing as also in the Star Wars universe. But it makes sense. May the Force be with you and also with you.
It is one of those things where, like, being raised Catholic, it's like almost like a default, like a reflex response when you hear "May the Force be with you." And then you're like, wait, no, wrong religion, wrong universe. But yeah, no, that was great to actually have that in the episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Dave Filoni played your wingman, as you mentioned. I mean, what was that like? I mean, I think we said in one of the other times you're on, he's a Kim's fan, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He and his wife, I think that's how he started watching Kim's, is his wife found it first and said, "You got to watch this." So thank you, Anne, so much for that. That whole series of events that if one doesn't start the whole chain reaction, none of this happens. Dave is great. He's like a nerd's nerd, but he's so down to earth. He's like everything for all the fans. He is everything you would imagine he would be. He's very, very humble. He's very unassuming, super smart, great storyteller, great sense of humor. In another universe, if he wasn't involved with Star Wars, I like to think that we'd be like nerding out in his basement, going over his Mecha Godzilla stuff and talking about hockey and just hanging out. That's his aura. That's the energy he gives off. And such a dream to act with him and to consider him a friend as well, because he's a real deal. He's a real deal. And it's nice. You know, they say never meet your heroes, but he's somebody that I think everybody would really, really walk away feeling like a million bucks. That's who he is in a nutshell to me. So
Let's talk about,
No, it was fun acting with him because that's so not in his comfort zone either. He kind of hates it. I don't think he likes attention drawn to him, but he's there. Originally, they wanted Deb Chow to play, to reprise her role and play my wingman. Mm-hmm. And she was like, no, not all Asians in space know each other, Dave, type thing. So it became that thing. So he came on and that was more fun to do. That was fun. And Brandon Wayne, who does the stunt, the doubling for the Mandalorian, he was on set as well. And he came up. He's like, so they give him Filoni a hard time. They give him lots of notes because he needs them. He needs a lot of notes. I think everybody gets a kick out of it whenever Dave has to suit up and get into the cockpit. And we shot a number of different takes where we're picking off the ice spiders. And I think Peyton was just they're using this for B-roll to have fun. And said, yeah, so Dave, play it like you're really enjoying it. Like you're just like, yeehaw! And I want to hear you say that. And they had Dave do these ridiculous things on camera, which was so much fun to watch. And then they had me reacting to it like, can you believe this guy? Like, why does he always do this every time? that was a lot of fun to sort of play with.
So how did this come about? Like I think you were sort of able to tell us part of the story last time, obviously while being very crafty about the NDA, but I think, the other time you were on the show, you mentioned a bit about your Mandalorian set visit, and how that all kind of started when you reconnected with your old colleague, classmate, Deborah Chow, at an awards show. So what, for those who didn't hear that episode and to kind of give us like now the full story, what kind of happened from there?
Well, my first set visit was pre-offer, pre-anything. It was literally just me bumping into an old friend and her saying, hey, Dave's a fan of yours and he wants to write something for you, and me being totally flattered. Anybody who works in the industry, everybody says, hey, yeah, I got something in mind for you, to be great. And you take all that with a grain of salt because that's the way the industry is. People say best of intentions, but realistically, it might not, it's probably not going to work out, but it's awesome that you're making that and you take it as such. And so my set visit was simply just as a friend to have this opportunity to nerd out, and Dave wanted to meet me and I really wanted to meet him. And so that's how it started. So that was easy for me to tell because that was me in dreamland visiting the set and seeing the child before season one had premiered, and them say, don't you tell anybody. And, nerding out with the props department and stuff. So that was easy. What happened later on was, I kept in touch with Deborah and she kept saying, he's writing something for you. And I keep saying, no, make it bigger. Don't give him a small thing, make it bigger, which is great. And then, in September of 2019, the climate strike, I remember that day very, very vividly. Everybody, we marched downtown Toronto, Queen's Park, which is our provincial legislature building. Mm-hmm. And I got a call from my agent who said, so Lucasfilm called and they want to know what your availability is. And I almost dropped my phone because I'm like, holy shit, it's happening. And I was like, whatever, I'll burn down forests. I will destroy bridges. I will dam up rivers. I will do anything necessary to make myself available.
Were you still at the climate strike while this phone call was taking place? Because I'm imagining you're getting some weird looks at this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's weird enough as it is because people recognize me from the show, first of all. And then so it was just this weird, what is happening moment. And so, yeah, I was like, yeah, whatever. And they're very secretive on The Mandalorian, obviously. And everything's got a code name. And I had no idea what character they wanted me to play or what it was. Was it going to be an alien? Was it going to be on an Imperial? Was it who? And as time went on and the paperwork and all stuff, because I needed to get work permits and to work in the States and whatnot, it became a little bit clearer what they wanted me to be. I knew he was going to be a pilot of some sort, but I had no idea what kind of a pilot. And when I asked, I said, look, I don't want to be a pain in the ass, but if you could find out any information to help me. And my agent said, well, she got back from Lucasfilm. Jon Favreau and Dave, they like to tell the actors sort of in person what the characters are. They don't want any of this stuff. And I thought, oh, okay. So I guess I'll have to wait till I get to Los Angeles to find out. Mm-hmm. And it was so funny. He called. They called me on my cell phone. And I missed the call originally. So I sent John Favreau to voicemail because we were eating KFC for dinner. And it just come, and I was doling out the food to my kids. And I looked, my phone is on silent anyways, and I'm at home. And I was like, oh, I missed a call. And it was like, get out. Oh, no. And I thought, geez, I missed John Favreau's call because I was eating fried chicken. So I called back, and then they explained to me who he was, who this character was. And the way John explained him is as sort of like, you know, it's like that beat cop that's been around the block. He's been serving, part of the old rebellion, and now he's serving in the New Republic in this manner. And the way he described them was like, okay, yeah, I get it. That's so much fun. And then, you know, they only send you the sides, your scenes that you're in. Everything is very secretive, and it's like triple layer security. They send it online, and they can monitor whenever you log on to see your lines and stuff. You can't print any of that stuff out. None of it. And they know exactly when you're accessing that information. So that was pretty, as an actor who likes to prepare, that was a bit, I hate working off of screens. I need physical printouts. I'm kind of old fashioned that way, and it's easier for my eyes. But so that was really neat. Yeah, that was, so that's how it all kind of happened. It was just suddenly a set visit and then months of nothing and me going, oh, okay. And then suddenly the call happening. So it's crazy. Yeah. It was crazy.
I think it's kind of cool to assume that your character and Deborah Chow's character are part of the same squadron as well. So maybe we'll see them on screen together sometime. I don't know.
We'll see. I mean, Filoni is, because he was part of that squadron initially. Yeah. Mm. And so is Rick. And so the three of them together, so it's part of the same sort of unit that is sort of going around. But it would be really nice to work with Deb, because she hates it as well. I think all kind of despise having to sort of go on. And I think it's just in their makeup in terms of like, we're happy behind the camera instead of being in front of it. But yeah. That makes it.
If only she was directing a more Star Wars series or something in the future. I don't know. Maybe there would be something there. Who knows? I'm just saying. Who knows?
Just spitballing.
Yeah.
Just spitballing.
I assume that, Paul, because they didn't tell you who you were going to play, that you weren't allowed to bring your own costume and just use that, because we know you've got them. We know you've got them stacked up in there.
There's a funny story about that, because I half jokingly, I said, you want me to bring my own flight suit? They were like, no, we'll make one for you. That was Favreau. He's like, yeah, we'll make one for you. Don't worry. And so they had it tailored to my dimensions, which was, wow, like that's next level stuff. But it was cool because during the wardrobe fitting, the wardrobe department is fantastic. They are fantastic. They are professionals, top of the game, and they're putting together, they've pre-constructed all this stuff, and they were going off of an old reference photo from a book called The Costumes of Star Wars. And the photos that they use are from publicity, like it's on a maquette, like on a mannequin, and it's just sort of hanging there, and obviously it's somebody who's just put it together with a passing knowledge of how the costumes are supposed to be put together. This is how I remember it, so that's how it's going to be. Because they weren't considering these pictures to be used as actual reference photos on how to recreate this costume. And they were using that as a template, and they're trying to figure out how to put the ejection harness on and the leg flares. And they were, you know, they're great professionals, but they're not huge Star Wars fans. So this is all still, I mean, and that's a deep dive anyways, trying to figure out how an ejection harness fits on an pilot's costume. You have to be a super nerd to really know that. And so, and they were self-professed Star Trek fans as well, which was hilarious. They're like, we're really sorry, we're Star Trek fans, but we're doing our and so we're putting together, and I finally stopped and I said, look, if you don't mind, I've actually built this costume, and on my phone I have these meticulously curated reference photos if you want to use them to sort of, and they're like, do you? And so they used the photos that I'd gathered for my build, and I was telling them how I connected to my costume and how they were sewed together. And they go, oh, okay, yeah, that's smart. And this is all knowledge I got from the cosplay community as well, and all these different build threads that I had researched. And for the leg flares, it was pulling down the boot or it was falling off. I said, look, this is what the cosplayers use. They have these clips that you use on the back of the, you know, the tape measures. They remove those. And you just put two of them on and it clips right to the boot and stays in place. And it was just, that was such a wonderful geek out moment as a cosplayer to be able to help and aid professionals. They do this for a living and they're great at it. These are award-winning, you know, costumers. And to be able to just sort of throw my two cents in, and it really felt very validating that all this time that I spent in the basement poring over these build threads with my wife shaking her head going, why are you doing this to yourself? It kind of paid off.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, it's one of the many reasons I cried so much during my wardrobe fitting. It was ridiculous.
They probably get that a lot, I'm guessing. I reckon that's probably an occupational hazard.
That's one of the lovely things they say about people who come on the show. A lot of them are huge fans and they all have that same wide-eyed giddiness of, can you believe this is happening and I'm going to be on the show?
And then there's these two jaded Star Trek fans fitting them up going, look at these guys crying.
look at these geeks. What are they doing? Now, a few people have asked us to ask you, did you get to keep the costume, the screen-used costume?
No, not one item, but that's cool because I hope to be back.
Yeah.
Like, fingers crossed. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's that one. You don't want to burn that bridge. Yeah. It's sort of like, yeah, we caught him at the border and he had like 17 items from the set stashed away in his pocket. Like, no, like 18 because I had one hidden up my bum. But no, I don't want to do that. So it's just you play by the rules and you kind of go, I'm not going to do anything to mess anything up. That being said, always, always, always make friends with the props department because they will, you know, invariably there's some really neat stuff that you have access to that, and they'll give you the deep dive on where it comes from. So I got to see the child and hold the hero version of it, and it's beautifully done silicone. He looks so real. And it's weighted and it's beautiful and all the lineage of all the different blasters. I got to hold a blaster that was actually used in Return of the Jedi. Things like that, where you just sort of like that experience of it in of itself, that's the best souvenir to actually hold that stuff and live it. Mm.
You've, as Bad sort of touched on, you've obviously cosplayed as an X-Wing pilot before. Can we now retcon those times that you appeared at, you know, conventions, et cetera, in cosplay? So and say that you were actually cosplaying as Carson Teva this whole entire time.
You know, it's funny because people say, oh, that's why. And it's like, no, these are literally, these costumes are years old. Somebody asked, so are you going to be cosplaying as yourself? And I thought, oh, that's kind of weird. It's fun, but kind of weird. I don't know if I'd feel comfortable doing that. It's really fantastic though. It's still overwhelming because it just like the episode just dropped yesterday, and I'm still floating on at the response from it all. And you know, it's this whole idea of your dreams can come true, and it's just the fact that I had all that stuff help. It's like we're talking about with the charcuterie board.
Mm-hmm.
That happened beforehand, if you look at the lineage and how it's linked, it's kind of worth the journey, and it's a fun story, and I think that's why a lot of people are sort of really enjoying my appearance on this, because they know I've been a geek for so long, and everything sort of connected, and everything had that reason, and the payoff has been just wonderful.
Yeah, I remember when you were on the very first time, we talked about how your Kim's co-star Jin Yoon was in The Expanse. Yes. We're like, are you jelly? Are you totally jelly that she's in? You've got one over on her now.
My character survived.
Yeah.
I should be involved.
We touched on like filming in the volume and stuff before, but just quickly, like, what was it actually like though, that first time that you kind of sat in an X-Wing cockpit? I mean, that must have been kind of overwhelming.
I didn't want to get out. I choked. I said, but you guys get the crowbars because I'm not leaving. You're transported. Like, it's one of those pinch me moments where like, is this real? I'm wearing a flight suit. I've got a helmet that has been custom painted. I've got a character name. My face is being shown. I'm sitting in a piece of actual Star Wars history. Rogue One, one of my favorite Star Wars movies. Sitting in this high-tech environment with a camera there, working with Peyton Reed, with Dave Filoni. It's just it's so surreal. It's pinch me. I'm dreaming. This cannot be real. And with that joy is the fear of don't fuck this up. You're terrible. Oh, you're going to hear it. And so it's, but that whole idea of finally realizing that moment where it's like, this is actually happening. I felt like Cinderella. I'd won the lottery, won the Super Bowl, World Series, Stanley Cup, everything all at once. The you know, the Grand Slam of tennis, Augusta, everything. I felt like a champ. And I realized too, how incredibly lucky I was. And it was that moment, the immense gratitude towards the universe to get me to this point. Because, you know, like you said, Clayton, when the movies ended, you kind of go, well, you know, that's it for the movies. And you're never going to get a chance to sort of play in that world. And with the continuation of that dream, the possibility of it actualizing is humbling. So, you know,
and not only did you get to fly an X-Wing on screen and lock those S-foils into attack position, but you also got to be a badass action hero at the end with a blaster. You know, you saved Mando and Baby Yoda. How did that blaster handle? What was that like?
It was heavy. That's a real world weapon. That was heavy. And the props department say, do you want the real one or you want the rubber one? Because the rubber one's lighter. We're going to give that to Filoni. Well, we're going to give you the heavy one because we know you can handle it. And I think they just sort of played up my ego because they wanted to give Filoni the lighter one because they're smart and they said, well, let's not hurt Filoni, but this guy, we can. It's cool. You're there, you're holding it. And then huge respect to Gina Carano too, because in that final two episodes where she's got the Browning, you know, they said they had a rubber one for her. She carried the real one, which is like, 5 times heavier than the one that I had. And she carried it around. She didn't have to, but she carried it. And so the amount of discipline and strength that you have to do that, to root you in realism. And it's like, I'm 5 years old again, and I'm recreating these moments I've played in my backyard. And so that's so easy to do when you're there, got the environment around you, and you've got this pretend gun. I had to stop myself from making noises though. You're making that noise. Yeah, you know, you don't make those noises.
I gotta tell you, when we were watching last night with my 7-year-old, and that scene popped up and he saw you guys with the blasters, he said, "Dad, that's the same blaster you use when you play Battlefront." It was like, yeah. So it did not go unnoticed.
Well, just quickly, just before we wrap, we'll run through a couple of just quick little Easter eggs and things like that to point out from this episode, because it's ostensibly what we do here. So they head to the ice planet. A lot of fans speculated that might be Ilum based on the trailer, or even maybe the planet from the end of the Clone Wars. But it turns out to be a planet called Maldo Crease. With Baz, you were saying that it's actually, I think, according to Wikipedia, that's the planet from like the first scene of The Mandalorian with the Mithril.
Yeah, where he tracks down the Mithril and there's the Ravenak that lives under the ice? I think apparently it's the same planet according to Wikipedia. I don't think that's an official source yet, is it? But yeah, it's a decent theory. It's certainly in the same vicinity as all this is happening in the Outer Rim, so it could be, yeah.
The spiders, obviously, Phil Shostak, friend of the show on Twitter, has confirmed that they are a new species, not the same spiders that we saw in Rebels or Fallen Order or anything else, but based on the same kind of unused Ralph McQuarrie concept art for a giant knobby white spider on Dagobah. How did you guys go with those spiders, by the way? Any of you guys are arachnophobic? Was that an awkward viewing experience?
Not for me. I'm not particularly arachnophobic. I actually just sat there kind of appreciating the visual effects sequence that they put together, which I thought was remarkable. It obviously, and my wife said it too, it obviously reminded, that whole sequence was kind of an homage to Aliens. Mm-hmm. And which then I started thinking, and I came up with this theory that each episode is going to be some sort of homage to a blockbuster from Jon Favreau's youth, because in Chapter 9, there were all these Jaws references, including a Hitchcock zoom. I mean, it was great. And here we get Aliens. And so I'm dying for a Raiders of the Lost Ark reference, and I thought the way you could do it is you have Mando and the child like running into one of those famously narrow Star Wars canyons, and a TIE fighter comes in, and the wings Ooh. Get sheared off, and all that's left is the center portion of the TIE fighter, and it goes rolling down like the boulder in Raiders. So that's what I'm personally, it's my headcanon. That's what I'm envisioning. So I'm hoping that each episode has some sort of new homage to blockbusters that we all loved. So anyway, that's my own headcanon theory.
Works for me.
I would love to see that. Yeah.
Definitely. Huge Aliens vibes in this episode. Also a little bit of The Thing in there with, you know, the giant nightmarish monster on the, you know, in the snowy environment, and when Mando starts using his flamethrower and all that sort of stuff.
There was a great reference to the callback to The Empire Strikes Back to the Minok.
Yes, it was.
It hit the canopy and you see that mouth go open. It was like, that's, you know, I those little callbacks are just lovely. In the entire series where they have those with Mando, and they're very, you know, consciously done with the R5, and you see the oil stain where the motivator popped out and just, you know, got wrecked. When you see R5 sort of going along when Peli calls it over, you can see that little bit. It's like, oh yeah, that's where the motivator went. And those little touches where they sort of explain things better or just sort of, you know, with the Cantonos is the biggest example, obviously. I love that because there's little touches that really sort of show that Favreau's a huge fan and he knows the universe and, you know, just sort of clarifies certain things as well.
I was going to say, it's probably pretty tenuous, but when I saw that Ralph McQuarrie concept art of the spider on Dagobah, I started thinking about how Baby Yoda's kind of attracted somehow to the spider's eggs. And maybe, you know, Yoda was obviously living on Dagobah. So maybe we haven't ever established where Yoda's from. Maybe Dagobah is Yoda's home planet. So maybe there's some kind of connection there. Maybe Baby Yoda sort of has some genetic memory of this sort of species of spider. I don't know. So it's possible they're signposting something there.
Possibly. I do like the idea that you know, me and you were just coming up with these explanations to justify Yoda eating these eggs when actually he was just being a little shit. But, you know, we'll find out in future episodes, I guess. Paul, I mean, I feel like we all know what your favorite moment in the episode must have been. But Clayton, was there a particular moment in this episode that sort of excited you most or that, you know, that you responded to the most?
I love the sequence where they were trying to escape from the giant ice spiders. I thought that was just terrific. Lots of tension. You really didn't know how it was going to go, and thankfully those heroic X-wing pilots showed up to save the day.
Yeah, I loved the chase sequence with the X-wings and the Razor Crest. I thought that was done really well, and some of the maneuvers Mando pulls off. You know, not every character can be an A1 pilot like Poe Dameron. I kind of get that Poe Dameron could probably have pulled that maneuver off, but Mando is doing his best. He's having a crack. He's still kind of banging off canyon walls and skidding the thing on the ground. But that was really tense. And, you know, the heavy breathing under the helmet, again, it's just fantastic kind of vocal work to replace the idea of having a face there you can see under stress. It's just so well done.
I always love any of those sequences where, you know, you've got ships kind of flying through in an atmosphere, flying through clouds. There's always something kind of like painterly about those sort of sequences. And this was another really good one. Paul, before we let you go, look, any talk about, you know, a Carson Teva Black Series action figure, a Carson Teva spin-off book, a comic, Carson Teva, a Star Wars story, the movie? What's, you know, anything on the agenda that you can talk about?
Fans are demanding it.
Yes. My wildest dreams. I have I have no idea. They have a plan. Nobody tells me anything. And so it's so flattering to hear all that. I will say that when I was there, though, and I think they do that with everybody. I had to, in costume, I had to sort of stand. They do this 3D picture of you all the way around. Like they map your body and they do that for everybody. And ostensibly, I would think it's for a possible action figure or this or that down the line. So I did have to go through that process, which I thought was really, really cool. Just never having experienced that before. So I have no idea. They did the stuff, the scans. if they ever do make a Black Series Carson Teva, I'm sure he'd be a peg warmer someplace. It drops in price. It's like they'll give you money to take it off then their hand thing. Or and then like 30 years from now, it'll be so obscure. It's like, do you remember this idiot? Oh yeah. And then he skyrockets in value.
Well, exactly. That's the path to legendary status in Star Wars. Is the more obscure they start off, the better.
Yeah.
And is there anything that could top this for you in terms of, you know, is there any franchise, like any other sort of role that could, you know, be more of a career high than this? Or is this it?
I don't want to be greedy. I don't, honestly, if this is it, then so be it. But if you're asking, I have a very deep passion for Star Trek as well. Mm-hmm. I play both sides of the fence because I grew up watching Star Trek on TV. And so that'd be fantastic as well. I actually do have some Star Trek cosplay that I'm going to be doing the deep dive on. And of course, everybody knows my Ghostbusters cosplay. I've got the proton pack. I got the jumpsuit. I got the PKE meter trap, everything. I mean, I got a couple of proton packs behind me right now. So, but I'm not going to be greedy, but since you asked, but this is a great one to end on if that's it.
Well, guys, thanks so much to both of you for taking the time to join us. I know, I mean, for both of you, it's an insane week. I mean, Clayton, you're an ABC News reporter in a US election week. And Paul, you're a man who just appeared in an episode of The Mandalorian. So thank you so much for taking the time to do this with us. And Clayton, obviously, sorry.
No, I wanted to tell Paul that you have a brand new fan in me. I had heard of Kim's Convenience. I had admit I had never seen it until I binged about 5 or 6 episodes last night. And I'm in love with Appa. He speaks to me on so many levels as a dad and a guy just trying to make it through the world. I very much appreciate that show. And also just the way you were able to keep this secret for so long. That's some next level wizard thespianism. We should give you all the awards. So anyway, thank you for that. And we look forward to seeing you in the Obi-Wan series.
Peyton, you're going to get me in so much trouble. Who's your Obi-Wan? I don't understand. Yeah, some kind of TV.
Well, that's going to make it quite the sneak attack when you do pop up in the Obi-Wan series now.
There you go.
I mean, look, if this podcast can achieve one thing, hopefully it's to get a few more people discovering Kim's Convenience as well.
Yeah, indeed.
I think that just about does us. Clayton, obviously, you know, we had so many questions for Paul today because, you know, he was in The Mandalorian, but
Of course, as did I.
I'd love to, you know, maybe at some point in the future, dive sort of deeper into your Star Wars fandom as well, if you'd ever want to.
Anytime, yeah.
Awesome.
Anytime.
That's great.
Just say the word.
In the meantime, Clayton, where can people find you on social media and around the internet, places like that?
Yeah, most often on Twitter, which is at Clayton_Sandell, CLAYTONSANDELL. And I'm trying to be better on Instagram. That's Clayton Sandell, ABC.
Nice. And Paul, how about you?
You can find me on Instagram under @AngryAppa. And on Twitter, @BitterAsianDude. And I also have a YouTube channel, Bitter Asian Dude Inc., where I do a lot of nerdy things on there too. So check those out, please.
Nice. And Baz, you're obviously Baz McAllister on Twitter.
I'm neither angry nor bitter, but I'm trying.
And I'm Rowan _ Williams on Twitter. Is that right, Baz?
You have to tell me
every week. I always forget.
It's great that you've now met a fellow _ user, which is fantastic.
And I should say, too, if you guys haven't checked out Paul's YouTube series that he just mentioned, definitely do so. That's kind of where I discovered that Paul, I knew him from Kim's Convenience, but that's where I realized what a true geek that he was. So definitely check that out. And you can find us at we are at Force Material on all the usual places, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, generally easiest to get a hold of us on Twitter. If you've enjoyed this episode, feel free to throw us a 5-star review on your platform of choice. We're certainly not going to say no. I'm Rowan Williams.
I'm Baz McAllister.
I'm Clayton Sandell.
I'm Paul Sung-Hyung Lee.
And you've just taken your first step into a larger world.
Okay, see you.
May the force be with you.
And also with you.